So far we've just been building up the representations of supersymmetry, the supermultiplets. So they're the one-particle states. But we need a field theory describing all the interactions between the states. So, we need to, in order to write down a sort of manifestly supersymmetric theory, it's useful to build these two constructions, superfields and superspace. So superspace would be the analogy of, say, color space for a quark, the space of colors. And a superfield would just be, you know, the color state of the quark. So this is going to be some weird space, which is a generalization of Minkowski space that we're going to build up. So we'd better just remind ourselves about ordinary scalar fields. So scalar fields, which are a function of space and time. So these are functions of the coordinates x mu of Minkowski, right? So of course this is completely elementary, guys. But I just want to remind you of all this because we're going to do the same. We're going to make sure build a superfield to be a function of coordinates of the superspace. So they transform, the fields transform. Ordinary quantum fields transform under the Lorentz group and under the Poincaré and Lorentz group in ways that we've seen. And of course, we've built up super Poincaré algebra. So we're going to want them transforming under that. So we want some objects phi of some coordinates which I'll specify, big X. So it's a function of coordinates big X of superspace, whatever that is, and transform under super Poincaré and Lorentz, super Lorentz transformations. So we have to ask, all right, you know, that's fine, but what's superspace? Well, so now, actually, we can identify the coordinates of Minkowski space with a symmetry transformation. And we're going to do the same thing, because we know what the super symmetry transformation is. And so if we can identify a coordinate with each one of those symmetry operators, then we'll know what superspace is. So I just have to remind you about defining a manifold from a group. Every continuous group G defines a manifold. MG. So if we take some, so there's a map lambda from G from the group itself to some manifold in space. So if we consider, you know, something like a Lie group with some parameters alpha A, one for each symmetry generator TA. So the space that we're talking about is actually just the space of parameters. So the manifold is this space of parameters. So let's just give some examples. That's the easiest way to see this. So let's take the group to be U1. So the elements of U1 are just, as you know, are just e to the I alpha q, where q is some charge generator. And then alpha is in 0 to 2 pi, and we identify 0 with 2 pi. And so, you know, this alpha space is just a circle, S1. So let's consider something a bit more interesting, SE2. So actually, I can parameterize any element of SE2 with the following matrix. So these are complex numbers, Q and P. So an element of SE2 is a 2 by 2 unitary matrix with determinant 1. And so we have an additional constraint, which is that det u is 1, which is mod p squared plus mod q squared. OK, so remember, these are complex numbers. So there are 4 real degrees of freedom hidden in them. This thing defines a 3-sphere, right? Because we have the sum of the squares of 4 real numbers on this right-hand side. And they've got to live on a sphere of radius 1 in a 4-dimensional space. So SE2 parameterizes a 3-sphere S3. Okay, for SL2C, actually, so we can decompose representations of this. Each element into a unitary bit, unitary times e to the h, where h is a Hermitian traceless matrix. Okay, it turns out that for SL2C you can do that. And we know that because it's a special group, the determinant is 1. Okay, so the determinant we can take determinants of each side, and the determinant of a matrix product is the product of the determinants. So this, if the left-hand side has determinant 1, then determinant of U has to be 1, and the determinant of this thing is 1, which means that trace of H is 0. Okay, I've just proved that it has to be traceless. All right. Yes. Say that again.
Like the point, because of the way you're parameterizing the 3-sphere, just using, like if I write P as like A plus IB,
mm-hmm.
It's just A and B that are parameterizing the coordinates on the 3-sphere. So if I take sorry, U star, like the conjugate of U, I still have the same A and B, and so I'm still the same point on the 3-sphere. So I have for different elements you have 2 different elements in SE2 correspond to the same point on the 3-sphere.
Yeah, it's supposed to, it corresponds to the 3-sphere, but if I identify opposite points, right?
I'll just use it 2-1.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, there's a.
I think it's a 3-sphere,
but it's just wrapped around.
Oh,
twice.
That's around place.
I think there is a double cover.
It becomes a 3-sphere when you impose determinant of U.
Yeah, that U equals 1. Yeah.
It becomes precisely a three-sphere.
It does.
Yeah, precisely. If you look, it just recently.
This thing has a double cover, right? That's the one with the double cover of SU2.
No.
The SL2C, right?
SL2C is a double cover of SL1.
Sorry, SO13, yeah. SU2 cross SO2.
It's the double cover of SO3.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, let's see, so... this is the double cover of SO3 because I can take P and Q to minus themselves, right? And I still, nothing changes here. So, so that's why it's the double cover of SO3. It's because of that minus one transformation. Okay. Right. So we have a 2x2 unitary matrix with determinant one. That's SU2, right? So this thing. U is S3, and this Hermitian matrix here can be traceless Hermitian. So it's traceless. So these Q primes have to be real, and the off-diagonal elements, of course, can be complex, but they have to look like that. Okay, so. We have three real parameters in here. One real one along the diagonal, and two real ones on the off diagonal. And there's no other constraint on this. They can go from zero or minus infinity to infinity. So each one of those just lives on the real line, right? So this traceless Hermitian matrix looks like R cubed. So the manifold for SL2C is a three-sphere times R cubed. So cosets define more general manifolds. So an element of our group is identified with all other elements where we multiply on one side or other. So for a right coset on the right by some element of another group. So, okay, that looks quite abstract. But I'll just give you some examples and you see what the deal is. So let's take... let's take the original group to be two U1s. Okay, discriminated them by this 1 and 2 index, but they're just U1s, right? So our group element looks like that, where the Qs are the charges and alphas are the parameters. And let's take H. The little group H to be e to the I beta Q1. So then we have a coset which is denoted G over H. So in this case it's U1 cross U1 over U1. Okay. And we identify, consider them the same, identify all points which are related by multiplying by some element of H. So looks like that. So we say that if we have some element G, which looks like this, we identify all of the points which can be multiplied by some element of h, and we just call it, we say, oh, that's the same under this identification as the original element G. So if I draw the space now of parameters, I have alpha 1 and alpha 2. Each one of these goes from 0 to 2 pi. And what I'm doing is I can choose beta how I like, and I can effectively identify all of these points along these lines. And so G over H just gives us a vertical, is just parameterized by this alpha 2. Okay. And all of these points, if you move this line left or right, they're all equivalent according to the coset. So hence, G over H is parameterized by S1, and it's just U2. So this coset is just U1, of the second unitary group. Yep. Beta. What we're going to do is actually set beta equals minus alpha 1, right? We just say, whatever you've got, whichever group element you've got, you identify all the points which are related by any beta here. So the reason I've got two pi's here is just with a U1, if you go around two pi, it gives you the same thing. So each of these alpha 1s and alpha 2s parameterizes a circle, so it just goes from 0 to 2 pi. Okay, so we can do some more examples. So SU2 over U1, coset with U1. So for SU2, we know now what this is. So, and we identify identify all points related by by a U1 element within SU2, and that is the diagonal generator of, the representations of U1 within SU2. It actually comes from the third generator of SU2, right? When you exponentiate the third generator, you get a U1, you can generate a U1 like this. And so, effectively, what this does is we can mop up the phase in alpha and make it real. Okay, so now this condition becomes, seeing as alpha is real now, we've got real part of alpha squared plus real part of beta squared plus imaginary part of beta squared is 1. So it becomes a 2-sphere. Okay, 3-dimensional space with a constraint like that is a 2-sphere. So this thing, locally, okay, there is this property of double covering, but locally, the algebra of these guys looks like, well, SU2 is locally similar to SU3, U1 looks like SO2 locally. So we can say that more generally, SO n plus 1 over SO n, if you work out what happens more generally, you get an n sphere. Yeah. Well, it means we're not worrying about these. We're worrying about small group transformations. We're not worrying about these global properties of topological properties of double cover.
Okay.
So if you do any kind of small, you know, something that's not double cover, then they're the same transformation.
Okay. Yeah.
It's just the topological properties that are different. Yeah. Right, so we don't necessarily need all of those examples at all, but I think they're useful in general, and it's just nice to see how it works. But what we do need in particular is to work out where we get Minkowski space from, and that's the whole point of this exercise that we're doing at the moment. So in fact, Minkowski is a coset of Poincaré group and the Lorentz group. And so Poincaré, general Poincaré transformation, as you know, looks like that. And we identify all of the points on that that can be reached by Lorentz transformations. And so we're left with e to the I x mu p mu, and therefore it's our x mu that parameterizes this manifold. So n equals 1 superspace is the coset super Poincaré over Lorentz. So an element of super Poincaré looks like e to the I. So we have all our Poincaré transformations. So now we have something with the q's as well. Yeah. Yeah.
Essentially, that's what you're doing.
Yeah. So. That's right, yeah. I mean, you could just define it as the group of translations.
Right,
you?
But
I mean, we just want to, it's just because we're going to do superspace by analogy with this case. That's why. Nice. That's why we've done it. So then, of course, we just identify all the points on that that can be. Well, strictly speaking, these are different parameters here on the bottom. But we identify all the points that can be reached by Lorentz transformations. And we can see now, immediately, actually, what our superspace is going to be. So superspace is x mu. And then it has some fermionic coordinates, or Grassmann valued coordinates. So n equals 1 superspace. So these are Grassmann valued And of course, alpha and alpha dot go from 1 to 2. So we've expanded space-time to have these weird fermionic coordinates. So instead of just 3 space and 1 time, we've got 3 space, 1 time, and 4 Grassmann-valued coordinates. All right, so now I need to remind you of some properties of Grassmann numbers. Yeah.
So theta bar is completely independent from theta. It's not just obtained by taking the bar of theta.
Yeah, in these coordinates, it's independent, I think. That's right. I think that's right.
Is it because of complex or something?
I mean, it's true that the... Yeah, they're complex. They're complex. They are complex coordinates. Well... actually, yeah, I'm confused on this point. Do you know, Cannon? We do consider them to be... We do consider them to be independent. You can build it... I think there are other ways of building it up in terms of, like, real Majorana, you know, coordinates and things. But, yeah, I'm not sure. Let me think about it for next time. Yeah.
The object in the numerator in your definition of superspace, is that an element of what is known as supergroup?
Supergroup. It's super Poincaré.
I mean, what is the mathematical? It's not a Lie group, obviously. No.
It's this super Poincaré. So it's a graded Lie algebra, right?
The algebra is. But what is the object when we actually exponentiate the Lie algebra?
I don't know, maybe a supergroup, I've gone, I don't know, that's not very mathematical, so I don't know what the definition is, yeah. But it's a group, certainly, but yeah. Okay, so, properties of Grassmann numbers. So you will have seen some of these in quantum field theory. So functions of them. So let's consider just one Grassmann number instead of here we've got 4, right? Grassmann valued quantities. But let's consider just one. So functions of one Grassmann valued theta are linear. And of course that just comes because they anti-commute, right? So we have some value. We can Taylor expand this. So we have some ordinary, you know, C number plus theta times another C number, and that's it. That's all you can have as a function. Yeah. I don't think it matters, right? Because even if it's non-analytic, the higher order terms are still going to be zero because you can just anti-commute the thetas. Isn't that right?
So any function that can be expanded as a power series?
Oh, sorry, that's your point. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, fair enough, yeah. Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's true. So if we have the derivative with respect to theta is just F1, of course, and we have some definitions with integration. When we integrate over, if we integrate just the C number by Grassmann value, we get 0, and if we integrate the Grassmann coordinate itself, we get 1. So a delta function of the Grassmann coordinates is equal to the Grassmann coordinates okay, so now theta alpha and theta bar alpha dot are spinners of Grassmann valued quantities. Lorentz spinners. And we have a convention where theta is defined with the southeast convention. So, you know, we sum these indices in that direction. And theta bar is defined with the northeast convention, like that, when we don't write the indices. And I remind you that this is something we derived a few lectures ago. So if we have the product of two of these thetas, we have minus a half epsilon alpha beta times theta theta. And if the indices are upstairs, and for the dotted index guys, you get plus a half times, Okay, you can work those out just by the definitions of what these things are. And if you can't remember, that's the safest way to do it. You'll soon, tomorrow, you'll be getting plenty of practice messing about with these things in the tutorial. Next, if we take a derivative like that, this thing is delta alpha beta, and to get the same derivative with indices downstairs here, you have to multiply it by epsilon tensors. And you'll find that you get minus sign. Then, and it's the same deal for the theta bars. Like that. Okay, and now we worry about the integrals given that we've got two theta coordinates. So we know that, you see, you've got to be very careful because now these differential elements also anti-commute. So you've got to be very careful about the order of everything. So I know that this, from the definition of an integral over a Grassmann coordinate, that this integral in the middle gives us one, and then the integral on the outside also gives us one. And this thing is a half. So now I can write theta 2, theta 1 in a different form. And I just write it as, use the epsilon tensor, use this star relation. to get it in that form. So if we define something d2 theta as a half integral d theta 1 integral d theta 2, then we have d2 theta of theta theta equals 1. So that's the sort of pleasing notation that aids the memory. And there's an equivalent thing with theta bars. And from d2 theta bar, theta bar, theta bar, this thing is also going to be 1. So we define d2 theta d theta alpha d theta beta epsilon beta alpha. D2 theta bar is minus a quarter alpha dot d theta bar beta dot d theta bar alpha dot. So we have this weird thing that the integral is the same as the derivative of this function f. It's quite a weird thing for Grassmann valued quantities. So if I want to write that down with these four coordinates, equivalently, I can write this d by d theta alpha, d by d theta beta, and so you can check by acting on theta theta with both of these sides that you get this, you get the right thing. Okay, so now let's see. We're going 40 minutes. Do we carry on? Yes, we do. So we can now define a general superfield. So definition and transformations of a general superfield. So first, recall properties of scalar fields, okay? So if we treat translation by some space-time coordinates a mu, as an operator, phi goes to e to the I a mu p mu. So phi is a field operator, right? So when we do a translation, that's what happens to the field operator. But phi is also a Hilbert vector in some function space. Curly F. So under the translation, phi of x mu goes to e to the minus I a mu curly p mu phi of x mu. And this thing is supposed to be the translated field. And seeing as it's a scalar field, that's just going to be the same thing as phi of x mu minus a mu. So we can expand this out by Taylor's theorem. The curly p, which is the representation of the operator p mu on this function space, is minus I d mu. And so if we expand out this first equation to first order, big P mu, this is what we get. So I'm looking for a commutation relation now between the field and the four momentum operator. So it's just minus a mu d mu phi. And this is the variation of the field under a translation. Okay. So we're going to perform the same transformation. On a general superfield, S. So remember, S now is a function not only of the Minkowski coordinates, but of the thetas.
If P mu and curly P mu do the same thing, then why are there two different
ways of looking at it? One of them, you know, looking at this as a field operator is a commutation relation, and looking at it, you know, just as a where phi is a Hilbert vector in the function space. I mean, it just acts in this different way, right? So, I mean, this is a way of deriving the commutation relation. I mean, I don't know what else to say apart from that, really. Have you got any comments?
I'm not entirely sure I understand the phrase Hilbert vector in a function space, but the curly P is what you get from classical fields. When you do quantum mechanics and you have a big Hilbert space, and the straight P is the operator that represents the symmetry
on a quantum field. Field operator.
The curly P is what you see from classical field theory.
Well, one of them is a commutator, right?
It's more general. It's the small variation of field operator phi is the commutator of phi and p, where p is the generator of the transformation, and the right hand side is the explicit, you know.
I'm just thinking if you add this on a test function or something, then when you use the product rule, you get exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. They're just two different ways of, yeah.
So the P is an abstract object, right?
Yeah, it's an abstract field operator.
It can have many representations depending on the situation. And then the small p is the representation. In this case, the derivative.
The derivative is the representation, yeah. So, yeah, that's right. You can think, yeah, I mean, you can define wave functions in terms of...
I mean, but we can write P...
Make, you know, Green's...
equals minus I mu, and it works if I is an operator.
Because you, when you... Yeah, okay. Yeah, if you sandwich it in between states, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. This is in position space, right?
No, I don't want to.
Okay. let's expand this thing in powers. Let's assume it's analytic and expand it in powers of theta and theta bar. So, the first thing we can have is just some function of x. Okay, that's going to be a scalar field. And we can have, so overall this thing is going to be a scalar. Okay, this superfield. And so then we can have theta, since it's Grassmann valued, times some fermionic field. We can have a theta bar times a right-handed fermionic field. We can have product of two thetas times some scalar field. And some theta bars times another scalar field. We can have a vector field, u mu, times that combination. So, of course, this whole... I mean, if the left-hand side is a Lorentz scalar, whatever we write down on this right-hand side has to also be a Lorentz scalar, okay? And so we've soaked up the theta and theta bar indices with this sigma mu, and then soaked up the mu index with the vector. And, right... we can also have a term like that, and so now lambda bar and rho are Grassmann valued fermion spinners, and then there's one term left which we can have, where D is a scalar. And that's all we can write, because anything else involves either three thetas or three theta bars. And that's zero, right? Because we've only got two indices. These indices only go from one to two. And so we could put one here, two there, and then you know, we've got to put gamma has to be the same as either alpha or beta, and therefore we can anti-commute and make it zero. So that's the general expansion of any superfield, n equals one superfield. Okay, we'll continue with that next time, I think. I think that's enough for today. Any more questions? Yeah, left and right-handed, yeah. Yeah, they've got an indexed alpha and alpha dot, so that means that they transform to SU2 left or SU2 right. No, it is a bit confusing.
I don't see the difference between